Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Making Sense of It All with Jesse Stakes. So my guest this week is LaShawn Smith of Kager Investments. They are a micro private equity firm that operates out of Seattle, Washington. They have a small team of 12 people that focuses on allocating permanent capital to buy, own, and operate profitable businesses that they really hold with no intention of selling. Their focus is on digital goods, membership sites, and software as a service. As you will soon hear, LaShawn sees this digital revolution that we're in the middle of as the perfect time to invest in small, nimble, and technology-driven businesses that are poised to take advantage of the current environment, but they need a capital injection to get there. Enjoy my conversation with LaShawn Smith. Let's jump into it. LaShawn, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Jesse, how you doing? Great to hang out.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time. So tell my audience about Kager Investments. What do you guys do?
So I say we loosely, we're a very small team, about 12 of us, largely contractors. And so I try not to make it sound like we're some big, massive company. But the focus is to build and buy companies powered by automation. We can get into what that means a bit more, but I have this thesis from working in very small companies to the very largest corporations that we're at the precipice of this new wave of automation being truly this lever that's going to, you know, allow any size business, but especially smaller businesses, to punch above their weight if they kind of pull in the right tactics and strategies. And so I am looking at companies that can be refactored, kind of turned around and become AI and or automation native, and or companies that are just getting started and that automation angle kind of gets baked into the organizational design and the go-to-market.
Hey, just to make you feel better, I refer to myself as we all the time when I'm talking about my show. So I don't know why, but it just happens.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing. It's crazy. I'm hearing more about automation and artificial intelligence, it feels like, in the last 3 to 6 months than I have in the last 3 to 6 years combined.
Right.
It seems like we've kind of hit that, to your point, we've kind of hit this jumping off point to where it's become, it's every single industry. It's not just one. It's not just two. It's every single industry that I'm talking to, whether it's manufacturers, if it is payroll companies, the IRS, government agencies of all kinds, everybody is talking about how they can get automation and artificial intelligence baked into what they're currently doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny how some concepts fall out of favor or maybe we forget about them, but can still stand the test of time. If you go way back to the 1950s, 60s, where manufacturing and here where I'm at in the U.S. was really prominent and drove the GDP, what we found were these consultants that would go around and figure out how to make your factory the most efficient. And that became, you know, kind of this discipline. There were these consultants, and this happened in Canada, in the US, in Germany, the UK, and Japan, all over where kind of industrialization was kind of hitting its stride, mid-century last year. And what they would do is like legit have like stopwatches, right? They would go and like time how long it took to, you know, make a bottle of Coke, how long it would take to, you know, slice this, you know, beef and get it all packaged up. And they were looking for all of these, you know, opportunities to identify the inefficiencies. And then they would, you know, come back with this report. Well, that discipline, sometimes called process engineering, has some other names, evolved into what became business process optimization. And once we kind of moved to the thick of, you know, kind of IT and software driven innovation in the 90s, we started to kind of forget about some of those things. And
sure.
What I really love about looking back at those practices is they had a whole playbook on how to look at your business and figure out what are all the steps that it takes to identify how the whole business comes together from the sales side to the delivery side to the support. And the result is, for me, is like, if we go take that old playbook, but we apply it to today's tools and business problems, we can be really smart in defining the process. And then once you define that process, it's not about saying like, hey, I'm going to go, you know, use this AI to automate my business. And like, it's some, you know, finger snap silver bullet. What you can do is to say, all right, I have 37 steps in my hero process. And these four right here, they're primed for automation. And so that's the way I look at it. And so the value of looking at some of these historical frameworks that have stood the test of time, I think is one of the really exciting pieces of why now. It's that we have this historical set of tools, but we have this new set of technologies to move them forward.
It's amazing how throughout human history, we really don't have to reinvent the wheel all that often.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to go look back, steal from some other place.
Right. You mentioned something there, hero process. Some of my listeners aren't going to know what that is. Can you explain to them what a hero process is?
Yeah, great call out. So I find that many people and a lot of the folks I speak to are folks who have recently left maybe a corporate job or some type of employment position, and they're moving into, you know, becoming an entrepreneur, maybe not for the first time even, but they're making that transition. They're the early days of their business. And there's a habit that I try to force people to break, which is don't think about all the departments at your last company when you're starting your new business. You want to have one product, one process. And once you get those ironed out, you can go and add additional pieces. And by one process, I'm saying take, again, all three of those steps, sales, delivery, support. And there's sub pieces there, right? So for some businesses, it might be a combination of sales and marketing. They might be doing ads. They might be doing organic. They might be doing, you know, trade shows and conferences. But there's something on the demand generation side of getting your customers. You have to actually deliver your product or service. And then there's always going to be a support or customer success angle. And so the idea of saying, like, all right, there's so many ways you could structure that to take all of the steps and try to make it as sequential as possible is the hero process. And what it allows you to do is to just have clarity of mind and not be a business of one or a small business and try to have four departments in your brain and all these kind of variants. And it gets really hard to make decisions with confidence when you overcomplicate how you structure things.
I like that. And it keeps it simple for people, and it calls it out to, you know, it's a powerful way to say it. So I like that you explained that to my audience there. So you invest in small companies. That's your goal, is to essentially identify small companies that you can make an impact with. How did you get started in this? What inspired you to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, well, you know, my journey has been pretty random. I started as a software developer, moved into what's called UX design. So the visual design of software, how do you think about what the users want, how to help them reach their goals? And then I went to business school. And after that, I was working primarily in product management and started managing teams. And the combination of those roles are really kind of the key pieces to kind of build, you know, most modern technology or at least software projects. And what I kind of stumbled on this. I didn't have some grand master plan. I was just, you know, I didn't want to do development, and I moved into design, and I wanted to have a different seat at the table to kind of set the rules. And so I need to do this product management thing. And just by kind of osmosis and inertia, the combo of those three roles led me into management and managing, you know, decent sized teams. And through that process, I got exposure and I shipped a lot of software products. And I really learned this muscle of what in the software industry we call going from V0 to V1. So you have some new context on some type of product you're trying to build. Maybe it's in a new industry or category even. And so there are no real rules because you're building something new. So how do you take that concept from version 0 to version 1? And that's what, you know, I kind of built my muscle around. And over time, as I got better at that, you know, as careers go, we find ourselves in a place where we're working on larger scope products for larger clients. And I found myself working for these Fortune 500 companies or building products for them. And frankly, I said, hey, I really don't care about these people. And it wasn't so much that the problems weren't interesting, but I wanted to get back to what excited me about technology. And that was really just the humans. And so right. The people inside of some big multinational company are very interesting, but a lot of times you don't end up building for them. You're building for the CFO or some, you know, whoever the sponsor of this project ends up being. And so I said to myself, all right, how can I take everything I've learned on building products and build for the people I actually care about? And so I went through this windy road. I was, I was coming off of an acquisition that I had made. So I had started a company. I got fortunate and sold it very quickly. And so then I just start saying, like, what am I going to invest in? And so I did what people sometimes do. I tried real estate. And while it worked, real estate should be boring on purpose. And I just didn't get enough intellectual stimulation. And I was like, all right, what else should I do? I invested in some feature films and made some movies. And we found some decent success there. I really don't like being on film sets. It's kind of like an event energy. And so while it's exciting, it's very draining. And so just not for my personality. And so I love helping, provide financial support to creators and artists, but I don't want to be on the set, right? It's just not my thing. And so I was just going through all of these different stages, trying to figure out, all right, how do I, find energy with this newfound set of resources I have? And after, I think I'm just under 30 angel investments. So I was investing in startups. And to get to that number, you obviously have to look at a lot of startups. I started seeing these patterns for venture-backed startups where they had so many challenges on just their operational needs, just how do they turn this idea into a company? And that just when you get these advisory updates or these quarterly readouts from these companies, it just started planting this seed that it's like, all right, there's a pain point here. I should pay attention. And so where that culminated to is I said, there's a whole class of people that I really care about. And these are people who are trying to find financial independence, find their financial freedom through entrepreneurship. And so if I could take that whole journey and figure out a way to go package that up and help those people, that's where I was going to get most excited. And so where I landed was a micro PE firm, and that's micro private equity. And all that means is, and frankly, it's a blend of almost like a holding company and a PE firm. For folks who are familiar with private equity in general, the big players, what they will do is go take huge amounts of debt to go acquire a company, turn it around, usually sell it in 3 to 7 years. My approach is a little different. As I said, I'm building and buying, and my goal is permanent capital. And that's a term that's used for capital you invest in a business and you don't expect to flip it or sell the business. You're buying it for cash flow. And so right. I make my money on the dividends, usually quarterly, that come from the profits of these companies. And so my focus is business services and SaaS companies that are helping new business owners accelerate their growth.
So your intent is to stay a partner with that business owner for the life of their business.
Correct. Now, so far, we haven't had anyone who has gone through a life stage. That will always happen, right? And So many of the businesses that are for sale today are folks that are aging out. They don't have a child or a relative to hand the business to. Maybe they're in their 60s or 70s, or they've just been doing something for 20, 30 years, and they're like, I just need something new. That eventually will happen to our portfolio. But for now, everyone either stays with the business or during the transaction, I bring on a long-term operator. They're provided with equity and the intent is for them to also stay with the business. And I don't get into the day-to-day running of each of these businesses. And so I really need a dedicated operator to make them go. And so they're on the hook to go figure out how to drive sales, what the organizational design looks like, how to think about, hiring, firing, people development, all of that. And again, we're trying to pick businesses that are very simple. So the product and delivery part of this is not complicated because people are complicated. Sales can be messy. Adding complicated delivery or R&D to the mix is not a good recipe.
No doubt. So can you share with my audience the first company that you ever invested in? And if you don't want to call it out by name, you can describe it if it's private.
Yeah. So let's go back to the angel days. When I was investing as an angel, I started investing. I had a thesis then that automation was going to be my thing. So I didn't want to just do generic SaaS or, there's so many trends, right? And I made some really bad bets. I explored the creator economy for a little bit and lost my shirt in that space. And so I do not play in that category anymore. But I started with automation, and There's a category called robotics process automation. And so that's RPA. And that is really taking legacy software and kind of clicking on, like, teaching the computer to click on things to extract data or to place data in there, and you can go and actually automate. And so I had done some deals there. I did some physical automation, a company called Pizza Robotics here in the Seattle area where I'm from. And, you know, that company has gone through a lot of transitions. And what I learned through all of those, kind of the punchline, is it's really hard to look at the most cutting, bleeding edge of automation and also try to build something new and try to, you know, build a team culture and, like, and, right? Continue to raise funds.
Sure.
And so for the companies that I have a more meaningful stake in, I said, all right, how can we make sure we're using the tried and true technology? Like, let's not get into mixed reality, you know, AR, VR, some of the things I've worked on in the past. So, like, that's not what these businesses need to be powered for. We need to do things like auto approvals and things like that. And so the first focus has been business services. There's a web design company, and some of the internal tools they use, for instance, is automating the pipeline and the transition from the designers to the developers. And it's a very small kind of shift, but it totally changes the economics of the business. And so, for instance, our designers use a tool called Figma, and it's a web-based tool that lets you design mobile apps, web, you know, websites, and what have you. And then we need to turn that into code, right? And so the old way is that the developer literally just kind of looks at the screen and clicks on things and says, oh, that's 32 pixels. And they go over here and type 32 pixels. Like, it's a ridiculously inefficient, you know, kind of world. And so we built some in-house tools that said, all right, I should be able to right click. We developed a little plugin, and then now we're going to get all those properties. And now we can just paste them in. Right. And so that's been a really, you know, that's kind of the playbook, is to find these inefficiencies and try to automate them. And the another example is our visual identity investment. So that company, you know, does logos and brand identity books and other types of things for companies. The book itself is very time consuming. It can take 30, 40 hours to put together. We call it an identity Bible, but to put together that whole book. We've just created a piece of software that takes all the raw assets and generates the PDF on the fly. It takes seconds to go, you know, output another PDF. And so that whole 40 hours, we can kind of split the difference with a customer. We can charge them less, and we don't have to eat those billables. And so this idea that you can take a service-based business, add some of these automation elements on them, and that makes, you know, a service business more attractive than maybe it was 5-10 years ago. I'm very bullish on that. And so that's where I've kind of landed. And I'm just continuing to look at that. We have 4 investments so far, and the goal is to double by end of year. Again, all in business services and SaaS.
I feel like there's so many people that are afraid of the rise of artificial intelligence or the rise of automation. They think it's going to take their job away. They think it's going to make them obsolete. And like I said, it's been coming up in a lot of conversations. And so some of my listeners may feel like I'm repeating myself with some of this, but it really is, you're driving efficiency for those people. You're allowing them to do their job better and more efficiently so that they give their customers their deliverables faster and really at a lower cost.
100%. And the way I look at it, you know, there's this sentence or phrase that's been floating around: AI won't, you know, eliminate your job. People who use AI will, right? And I think there's a fair amount of truth to that statement. But more specific to this conversation, I believe what's going to happen is that the middle-sized companies are going to be under a lot of pressure. Many of them will not survive. And so the big multinational mega companies, they will be around. They'll be just fine. However, there will be an explosion of small companies. And this is my whole thesis, right? I'm betting my career and my investment strategy on this thesis, that there's going to be an explosion of these businesses because they don't need to have massive teams. And they're still going to need to do things that are potentially outside of their core value add, right? So if someone says, you know, I am, you know, I'm an accountant. Well, maybe that person doesn't need to go and do all the, you know, maybe they don't want to run their own marketing. They don't want to run their own backup house. They don't want to, you know, run their own, you know, weekly business reviews or whatever the job is administratively or marketing wise, they don't want to do. they can start outsourcing those things to these types of service providers. And I have, you know, no love lost for a company going out of business, because I believe the humans inside those companies will be just fine. Now, that transition period is scary, right? Because the perception of having a stable job, you know, here in the US, we have W-2s, and that's what we even call the employees sometimes. You know, you're a W-2 employee, you're a full-time employee. And there's this, there's this idea that, oh, that's the more stable option. And over time, I think we're going to move as a society to a place where that is that's not necessarily the case, and that you can have both job security, and I don't even look at it as job security, it's more cash flow security that most people are looking for, and have more time to spend with friends and family, because you're going to have more flexibility on how you kind of structure your day. And so I'm really excited about this new wave, because I use this term, the VSB, the very small business, and that's 20 or fewer employees. So 0 to 20 employees on purpose and planning to stay that way. I think
you're brutal entrepreneurs.
Yeah. I think we're going to see businesses of that size do $100 million a year. Now, those will be the exceptions, but I think we're going to see like that level of output and, you know, the old accounting term, employee contribution margin, ECM. That is a term and said, like, how much revenue do we make per employee? We're going to see crazy numbers, you know, not a half million dollars. I'm talking, you know, $5-7 million per employee, because they have this, you know, superpower when they pair up with AI.
Right. It's possible now, whereas before it wasn't, because you only have so many hours in the day, or you only have so much output that one human can do. But to your point, when you have a partner that has almost unlimited output, that's it gives you an exponential return.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing on that topic that, and I don't know, you know, some of the business owners that you talk to, I'd love to hear maybe an anecdote or two of some of the more practical fears that you're hearing. But one of the conversations I had that was quite interesting was someone who owns, it's kind of like a powder coating shop. They do like body shop work, and they powder coat small kind of components for businesses. And he said something that, like, it clicked in my brain. I was like, oh, this is one of the insights I was missing. He said, I've spent years kind of, you know, crafting my craft, investing in this and becoming good at this. And now, you know, these new tools and technologies are just going to go wipe that away. And the reason that was non-obvious to me is, working in technology, that has always been the case. Every 2 to 3 years, you've had to totally reinvent your stack. Now, yes, mm-hmm. your critical thinking, your interpersonal skills, you know, all of that stays the same, but there could be a totally new language or new tool. And so when I look at maybe the lack of empathy that we're sometimes seeing from folks in the technology industry, they're like, big whoop, like, what's the big deal? There are folks who have spent 20, 30 years investing in a craft, and this is the first time that they've ever had to face this, you know, fork in the road that potentially this could get wiped away, or it could be devalued, right? And so I just think that was really insightful for me to learn, because, you know, I just assume everybody was okay saying every 2 to 3 years, you know, I don't care what you learned in school, you got to go learn something new. And that largely isn't how the workforce thinks.
No doubt. Well, and to answer your question, I think a lot of the people that I speak to that have process-oriented jobs or mm-hmm. businesses, on the physical labor side, you know, you could take somebody who works in a car factory. They do a job that used to be, you know, considered skilled labor, to build an engine or to paint a car. And now you have robots that have sensors that can do that same job 24/7, that do it just as good, if not better, than what they do, because they're not going to have the imperfections that a human would, as far as the flaws that could potentially be caused by human movement or distractions or different things like that. I would say on the white collar side, when you have people, let's use the payroll industry, and you look at people who work at the IRS or who work at a payroll sales company, as far as providing payroll services, there's a lot of tasks behind the scene that are just repetitive tasks that they do every day.
Right.
And I think some of those people, again, it creates fear, because to your point, they've done something the same task over and over again every day, day in and day out, for their full career. And then if they were promoted to training people or to supervising people who do that same task over and over again. So those things are going to go away. Those people are going to be asked to get outside of their comfort zone and to have a broader thought process on what do I mean to this organization that I work for or that I own.
Yeah. I mean, one of the areas that I've looked at, and I haven't found an investment. So if any of your audience folks out there are in this business, I'd love to hear from them. But the retraining and upskilling piece of this is many times focused on the hard skills or the upskilling. So, all right, you know, you used to work in a coal mine. We're going to teach you how to code. Like, that's silly, right? I don't like, it's just not a practical thing. You know, you have some 58-year-old who has been working with their hands and it's like, now I want you to sit in front of this computer for 11 hours a day. Like it's silly. Not saying some of those folks won't want to and do that. I saw this great post on LinkedIn where this guy was 70 something years old and he just graduated with a bachelor's in AI. And I was just like, I love that. Right. But those are going to be the stories that we celebrate because they are so rare. What I think will happen more practically is that folks don't necessarily need to learn how to code or learn how to do some other thing. They need mindset training. And the business that I've been kind of exploring, looking around is, you know, how can we help people have the right accountability and social support structure? I don't know what somebody will pay for that. You know, is that $100 a month, $200 a month, but some type of service that helps them reorient their mind so it becomes more fungible. So, you know, effectively, you know, we have apps for meditation, we have apps for fitness, we have apps for nutrition. But this idea that if you can, you know, make your mind, you know, having that growth mindset more flexible, that's going to allow you to observe, see, and, you know, kind of attach to new opportunities because they're out there. And I don't like this binary, like, oh, you used to do this very hands-on frontline worker physical thing.
Right.
Now you need to be like that. No, but whoever that person is, whatever their journey, they do need a mindset shift. And I think for some folks, they're going to need some type of paid service to help them on that journey.
I don't disagree. And I have found throughout my career and also just interacting with people, people have different learning styles. And I think that as we have gone through this journey of becoming more digital, not just automating and not just, you know, not talking about the technology piece, but just everything is kind of moved towards a digital process. Companies have looked at this as a potential cost savings, and they've taken a lot of learning and development and moved it from classroom settings to digital settings.
Yeah.
They've taken some of the options out of the question I always like to ask somebody is, how do you learn? And a lot of people don't even know how they learn, but people do have different learning styles. And so if somebody is a physical learner, if they learn by doing, or if they learn by sitting in a room with somebody and actually listening to them speak, some of those folks, we're losing some of them just because they don't embrace the new learning styles, or they don't right. benefit from them. So I think that there's a huge opportunity in what you're speaking about, but I also think there's another opportunity to supplement that with catering to the different learning styles that people have and making sure that we're bringing everybody along and not just losing people kind of out the back of the wagon as we move forward on this journey.
100%. And, you know, I find it really interesting, you know, the paid coaching business, because if you have a business that's working and you need to kind of get to that next level, I've seen it multiple times. Somebody will pay $50,000 for a coach and it's like a huge unlock. And so I'm a huge believer of like using that as part of your toolkit. However, I see folks who are much earlier in their journey and, you know, they're paying $1,000 for a coaching service that's in a $25 book. And I think really what they're doing, it's the same thing that, you know, happens when people go to the gym. You know, maybe you need to pay, you know, for one or two sessions to learn the equipment, not hurt yourself. But most of those folks, if they really ask themselves, are paying for accountability. They need to force themselves to show up. And so if true. You're a business owner, and I hear it so many times, I need more capital, I need more time. Spending that cash on a book, to me, you know, the right set of books, these durable books, not, you know, like not the latest fad, but it's some of the best coaching that's out there. And so a lot of times, again, I think people need the accountability, the social structure. It's not so much that they can't get access to the right information. It's just they need to figure out how to make the time so they digest it properly. And to your point, some folks aren't going to want to read a book. So maybe they need video or maybe they need in person. And so yes to, you know, kind of accommodating people in different ways, but also, you know, reminding people like, if you want to, you know, the three ways they say, you can do it yourself, you can, you know, I can do it with you, or I can do it for you. The further you get along in that spectrum, the more you're going to pay.
No doubt. So LaShawn, I want to kind of get back to the reason why you joined my show today. You are looking to invest in more companies now. You're looking for opportunities. And can you share just specifically with my audience some of the opportunities that you're looking for right now?
Yeah. So again, business services and SaaS companies, so software as a service. And typically, I'm looking for $500,000 in EBITDA, so or SDE. So folks not familiar with those acronyms, I'm really looking at ultimately how much cash does this business throw off. And you know, most of the time, these are going to be businesses that have been around for at least a couple years, just so there's enough kind of data there to really be able to assess the health of the business. What those two focus area means is that I don't do direct to consumer product. I don't do any physical product. I don't do consumer businesses. Those are kind of out of my window. And what I'm looking for, they can be based in Canada or in the US. I've not done any international deals yet. I'm still trying to work with my attorneys to understand how I can do that. So that's LaShawn needs to learn some more, not like I'm against it, but I can only do so much at a time. But I love what they call, you know, local monopolies. And, you know, those are businesses that aren't going to have a ton of competition because there's something kind of local in nature to their business. And I believe I can, you know, add more value. So here's an example of something that, you know, in business services that may not be obvious. There was a commercial roofing company that I was looking at, and very interesting business, had been around 25, 27, like 20 some odd years. So this is very, you know, the owner was retiring and, you know, he had kind of this turnkey business and it was kind of like on autopilot for the most part. And so we did the NDA. That's usually the first step. I look at the data room. That's usually the next step, kind of looking at the banking financials, kind of, you know, if there are any loans, debt, you know, just kind of understanding the financial health of the business. And then if we get to the right stage, you know, they're usually in a deal, even these smaller deals, there's something called a key man clause. And what that is are the named individuals that the acquiring company, in this case, Kager Investments, says these folks have to stay for me to say this company is worth X, because if these three people leave or what have you, whatever that number is, this is less valuable because they are critical to some part of the business. And yeah. And so most people who are working with a business broker, they know everything that I just said, right? Like they have all of that ready.
It's a pretty standard financial package.
Yeah. What I like to do is I want to talk to a random person. And so sometimes the business, you know, people don't say the business is for sale. They don't always want a bunch of looky-loos in the business. Also, people want to move fast. I pride myself on getting to a term sheet relatively quickly. And so you don't want to drag this process out, but I want to talk to a real human, right?
Sure.
And so I went and I said, hey, I want to talk to one of your folks who are actually doing the work. I don't want to talk to anybody in the office. I've already, you know, said hello. Everyone seems nice. I actually want to talk to the real people. And I had, you know, just a 30-minute conversation, and it was very obvious from that 30-minute conversation I should not invest in this company. And the biggest reason, and I, you know, the guy was very honest, but I could read his body language and kind of his, you know, kind of his thing. There's no purpose or mission. There was nothing that the previous owner had really baked in to say, like, why do you going to get on this hot roof? And this company did mostly rubber roofs. So if you've been on like a big apartment building or office building, they go service these every quarter. Somebody has to go up there and get all the bird stuff off, make sure there's no leaks, blah, blah, blah. And that's why it's an interesting business, because it's recurring by nature, right? You can't let your roof get in disarray. But he was just such a nice person, but he was like, I just don't care about this job. Right. And what I don't want to have to do is buy an asset and it be a total turnaround. I'm looking for businesses that are, you know, financially in pretty good shape, but more importantly, that the people like working there and then show up and say, we're going to make this place amazing. Because if that cultural part is broken, there's just so many risks on how things could go bad. You could have max exodus on quitting. You might have to terminate a bunch of folks. Now you have a big talent and hiring issue. And so for me, it's a fairly wide range on business services, and I like businesses like that. But it's very important that the people are happy and excited to work there, because that's one of the hardest things to fix quickly.
No doubt. So if somebody checks all those boxes and they're interested in getting in touch with you to have a deeper conversation about something, how can they find you?
Yeah, I'm pretty accessible. If you want to have a casual conversation, you could reach out on Twitter. That's at LASEAN. And if you actually have a deal that you're interested in discussing, you can reach out at Kager Investments. And the email address there is grow@kager.com.
LaShawn, I want to thank you for joining me today. It was a very enlightening conversation, and I hope that my audience got as much out of it as I did.
Likewise. Nice to catch up, Jesse.
In our conversations, LaShawn has talked a lot about doing work worth doing. Well, he's passionate about his purpose, and from my perspective, it looks to be in line with where the world is headed. He knows exactly what he's looking for, and he has a playbook that works to get there. That's going to wrap us up for this week. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with LaShawn as much as I did. I'll catch you guys next time.